Hello everyone and welcome to RealCom webinar. I'm Lisa Woods, your host for today, filling in for Chuck Nyswanger, who's on a cruise ship somewhere in the Caribbean right about now. We hope Chuck and his wife Kelly are both having a wonderful and well-deserved vacation. We have a great webinar for you today. The topic is Data Fusion Mastery, a blueprint for streamlined enterprise integration. Thank you for tuning in. Before we get started, let me go over a few housekeeping items that will help you to have a great webinar experience. First, again, thank you for joining us. We know there are many demands on your time these days, so we appreciate your attendance and active participation on our webinar. If you have any questions or comments during the program, please use the Q&A box at the bottom left of your screen. We'll try to get to all of your questions, but if they don't get answered during the webinar, we will follow up with you afterward. For the best webinar experience, we do recommend that you close out any of your other internet applications, especially streaming videos, which might affect your bandwidth. If you are experiencing any technical issues like with connectivity or sound or video quality, the best thing to do first is to disconnect and try coming back in to see if that resolves the problem. You can also email Ian at ithompson@realcom.com for help during the event. That's ithompson, I-T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. At realcom.com, and he will do his best to help you out. Finally, a copy of the webinar recording will be sent out to all of our registered attendees later today. We will also include Chuck's email address in case you're watching the recording and have any questions for our panel. This educational webinar is supported by four outstanding sponsors from our community. We want to thank them for their support and participation. HQO's Real Estate Experience platform converges data, technology, and the customer through the only end-to-end experience solution transforming real estate to drive tenant and employee engagement, satisfaction, and retention. Thank you to HQO. LinkSpring develops, manufactures, distributes, and supports edge-to-enterprise solutions that create smarter buildings, smarter equipment, and smarter applications. LinkSpring is at the forefront of moving buildings from smart to smarter. So thank you to LinkSpring. MRI Software's comprehensive and flexible technology platform, coupled with an open and connected ecosystem, meets the unique needs of real estate businesses, from property management or property level management and accounting to investment modeling and analytics for the global commercial and residential market. So thank you to MRI Software. Today's silver sponsor is DevRabbit. DevRabbit provides leading design and development services for the CRE space. Services include web development, CMS, CMMS, CRM, leasing and accounting system implementation and integration, mobile app development, analytics, cloud migration, DevOps automation, data science, AI, machine learning, and managed services. There is never a one-size-fits-all when it comes to technology needs for the CRE space. CRE brands require custom work. However, resources for custom development are limited. We're grateful for the support and leadership of all of our tech partners and what they provide to the industry and for helping us educate our community in sessions just like this one. Our moderator today is Andrew Weakland, Senior Vice President at WP Carey and Director of Systems Development. Welcome, Andrew. I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you for the warm introduction. I will say your jokes don't quite compare to Chuck's, but otherwise you were a perfect stand-in. So thank you for sparing us from the corny humor. Welcome, everyone. As Lisa said, we're going to be talking about data fusion mastery today. That can mean a lot of things, depending where you come from in the commercial real estate industry. To me, it's pretty simple. Fusion is bringing things together, right? So obviously integrations are a key part of that, but bringing data together is how we can maximize the value for our enterprises. At WP Carey, we're very lucky that we've been a data-driven organization from day one, going back over 50 years. But however, we constantly find ourselves in a cycle of reinvention, right? As technologies change, become more powerful, become more broad and capable, as demands change from our business users, whether it be executives looking to make better deals or folks in other operational roles trying to optimize their internal processes, the demand for data is an ever-present, you know, it always slants up, right? There's never been someone that said, I need less data in my decision-making. And with powerful tools coming on, like what vendors call AI, it's more important than ever to make sure your data is clean, ready, and talking to each other. So we're going to explore today, talking to both people in the industry as well as vendors that support it, is how to achieve excellence in whatever you're trying to do with your data, right? How to assess yourself, know where you stand, how to improve, and how to set a plan in place to always be getting better over time from different angles as well. We're going to talk about things from the office perspective, specifically things around IoT. It's really a full array of things, as well as getting into the weeds a bit with some questions. My goal today is simply to be a proxy for you, the audience. So please, Lisa said, leverage that chat window, ask as many questions as you have. If you have a really good one, we'll actually pause the speaker and interrupt them and say, hey, we got this great question, let's tackle it now. But we're also going to have Q&A at the end, 30 minutes, depending on time. We can really get into the weeds on your questions. If this really is for you, the audience, to get the most out of. So please ask any questions you have, whether you're just starting your data journey and wondering, you know, what comes first, or if you've done this before and are really going to get specific around strategy or tactics and how to tackle certain challenges in your data fabric, as it were. So please ask the questions. Otherwise, I'll have to ask the questions, and I don't want to make this about me. It's supposed to be about you. So with that out of the way, let's introduce our first speaker, Abby Shockley, Kimco Realty. Abby, come on. Please join us. Hello. So Abby Shockley has been working in the data world since 2015. After getting her PhD in physics, she transitioned to the corporate world, working in a variety of roles. She's covered cybersecurity, healthcare, retail marketing, and now real estate. As a director of enterprise data and projects at Kimco Realty, she plays a key role in how data is governed and used to support business decisions. And Abby, you have the privilege of going first, but also responsibility. And I know you're going to set the framework for us so we can kind of understand where we stand in our self-assessment as a data organization.
Yeah, hi everyone. And thank you for that great introduction, Andrew. So what I'm going to go through in this set of slides is what I call the data maturity model. So it gives you a framework for how to assess where you are today and, you know, where you might want to go in the future, as, you know, maybe you're building out, maybe you're further down the line. And then just these slides are available to download. So if you want a copy, you can get them. I think they're available in the chat. So to kick off the data maturity model, so what I'm going to go through, there are five different phases that I've cycled things through into, and these are all publicly available. It should match a lot of other sources, but you can start from, you know, we basically do nothing, to level five, where, you know, you're the leader in the industry. Everyone is coming to you asking you, oh my God, how did you do that? So in each of the levels, what I'll go through is there are five categories that I think you need to assess across. So do you have an insight-driven culture? And so that's, you know, about the state of your organization as a whole, and how do people think about data? How do they bring it in? Is data used to help you make strategic decisions? So how is that organized into what everybody's doing day to day? Like, how do we make the business better? Do you have processes that go with it? And do you have good analytics processes to help you inform your strategic decision making? Do you have talent and training? So if you're making tools, people actually know how to use them. They know what to do. They know what questions to ask. And then the last one, which is also sometimes the most important, data governance and ownership focus. So do people have ownership over the data in your organization? Do they feel responsible for it? Do they know what choices they're making and what impacts they have day to day on the data? And I'll probably not spend too much time on each of the slides, but I'll go through them really quickly. So level one, right? That's, we don't really do very much. We don't use data all that much, except to do financial reports and things that are necessary to run the business. Like, some people might do some analytics here and there, but it's not a regular thing. We have a lot of spreadsheets and things that are, you know, stored locally. We email them around to talk about what data means. And there's probably a lot of value that you can add that you're not accessing right now. And then level two would be, hey, I'm just starting to recognize, I'm starting to hear from my executives, like, how do we get analytics better into our process? What do we do from here? How do we start, you know, creating data dictionaries that say what things are and where they're kept and where they're put? You might not have a data person yet. You might be looking to hire one. And then your culture, it's not really ready to start taking in data. And then level three is the last one that I'm going to talk more about, which is, you know, you're really progressed a lot once you get to level three. Your executive team is looking to see, where are my analytics insights? your IT team, your business has worked together on what the policies and procedures are for certain things. You can start seeing analytics entering the operational workflows. You start seeing strategic decisions being affected by whatever data you're collecting in your organization. I'm going to skip level four. Just gonna leave it up for a second so everyone can see it, but you can download the slides again. And level five, most businesses don't get here, so I would not be too concerned about this one, but I'm gonna leave the slide up for just a second. And then I'm just gonna go through quickly like examples of each level, and we'll just again do one through three. So if the business comes to you and they have a goal, hey, like, I'm trying to figure out how can I get better at making double-digit leasing spreads across the portfolio. That's what I want to be announcing. You would have to take that business goal, walk it back to an analytics question. So you might say something like, hey, if we look back over the past 2 years, what are the drivers of the highest leasing spreads we've had in the portfolio? Maybe that'll help us identify better deals. So when you're at level one, you go, well, we can't do 2 years. Maybe we can do the last quarter, and it's gonna take someone a really long time because we only have this one person who knows what to do and no one else knows. Level two, which is more mature, says, oh yeah, we can do that. Like maybe a year, we got a few people who can handle that. It's not gonna take that long. It's not gonna be that fast, but it's still gonna take a while. And then when you get to level three, you start talking about, oh, hey, like we already have that data available. Everybody knows what it is. It's all right here. We've already given people access. They know to go in and look, and they start talking about, hey, here's what we're doing with that. Here's where things are. And they have started to integrate that into their workflow of stuff that they look for to help them do their jobs. Level four is more in my mind where you're getting into the predictive stuff. And so that's where like, hey, I can identify what tenants I should have in this space. I can tell people when to reach out to them or who the best ones to contact are. And that's definitely a lot harder. So most people aren't necessarily gonna get there, but I think a good sweet spot for real estate companies is try to get into the level two, level three area. And then I think that is my last slide. So Andrew, if you wanna come back.
Absolutely. So let's do a quick exercise and self-assess some of our data practices here at WP Carey while we wait for the questions to come in. I do find, you know, we're making a push right now for level five, if you will, in a very specific part of our business, but other parts are definitely still down in the twos and threes. I think that's because different parts of the organization just interact with data in different ways. That would be kind of my question as well, is that as things progress and technologies change, I do feel like the stages kind of shift a bit as well. Predictive was not a high priority for anyone 10 years ago, but I would say ironically back then, our governance was top notch. Our ownership lineage governance was great because there wasn't as much data. Things were a lot simpler and we were trying to do less with it. So from that lens, like, is that a reasonable thing in your assessment to look at each part of the organization through a different lens based on what they're doing and based on how they interact with data?
Yeah, I think when you first start looking at a maturity model, maybe you want to look at the whole organization and figure out where everyone is just as a rough assessment. But as you start maturing more, that's where you can start saying, okay, well, like we're level one today, but I really want our sales team to be a lot stronger. So I want to get them to a level four. And what can we do to support that? So what IT measures do we have to put in place? How do we help the business so that we can bring together on that one focus area? And that's where I think people like to start with sales because sales is the revenue driver. So you want to do leasing first. And then the people that, or, you know, you get accounting and accounting gets really strong data governance and ownership because they're audited. And then you have other areas where you're like, well, like property management, do we really need to help them right now? Because that's going to cost us money and they're a cost center. I don't know that we want to do that. So like as you're thinking through the whole picture, you also kind of have to look at those pieces too, right? So where are your cost centers, where are your revenue drivers, and how do you put your like data money in the right place?
No, that's always it. It's always a cost benefit in these things. And one thing I found as well, though, is there is kind of a tipping point where once you do have a centralized repository, golden records, however you refer to it, that every department's relying on, you get those spillover benefits. So sure, maybe you defined all the properties down to every square inch for the leasing team to drive their leasing model. That's also useful for the property accounting team or somebody else, right? Because you have that cohesive structure in your data that can propagate out to the different teams. What about self-service? You mentioned self-service is one of the things in level four, like creating data products people can consume. We found internally, you know, we have a couple folks that are willing to do that, but most people don't see themselves as data scientists. Even if they spend all day building financial models, they don't want to have to go that extra step to truly do self-service analytics. Is that a bring a horse to water and hope they drink situation, or is that really something that we need to push for as technologists as these things progress?
On that a lot of people who have tried to get self-service in the organization find that it just creates more chaos, right? Because people don't know what they're doing. So then you get analytics process one, analytics process one, two, new, and then you kind of get some things that it becomes harder to understand. So I think what you really need to do, it's not something that's for everybody, right? So you have to choose who to focus on. Like I find your finance partners tend to be a lot more data savvy and tend to want the tools to be in their hands so they can do stuff for themselves. But you have other people like your leasing team that's just like, just show me what you want me to do and then I'll just go from there because I don't want to have to think about extra things. So like, self-service from a BI perspective where you're giving people a dashboard and asking them to look at it, that's pretty easy stakes. From an analytics perspective where you're saying, well, here's the data and now I want you to do extra stuff with it, you really have to be careful about who you're picking as your target audience to help with that.
Right. We've run into that too, where people are hungry for data, but they're a little bit scared to pull the lever themselves. They'd rather export it to Excel where they just feel more comfortable, even though the task they're doing is much easier to perform in a data-driven tool. So that's also something interesting to confirm. Any final thoughts before we move on to our next panelist? I think it was a great way to lay the foundation so people can kind of see where they're at in their journey.
I still say like it's always about people and process. So you have to make sure like as you're building out your technology roadmap, just keep in mind like people and process have to use it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Abby.
Thank you.
Aaron, you're up next.
Hey.
All right, I'm there coming. You are.
Yo.
Hey, Aaron. All right, Aaron is the Director of Commercial Real Estate Technology Initiatives at CAR. You lead the IT innovation efforts and is the architect and developer for CAR's data analytics, IoT, machine learning, AI, and hospitality platforms. Aaron's focus is on IT innovation around data automation and return to work movement. So with that out of the way, Aaron, what's going on at CAR? What level are you at today and where are you going?
Andrew, it's good to see you. Abigail, you did an awesome job walking us through, and it really like left me with some questions on how we can get to level five organization. I think we're probably between four and five, I'd like to see, but there's definitely some gaps. And one of really my biggest business case user groups is in operations. And I have to, and I'm there's likely that there's nobody from operations from CAR on this call particularly, but I have to give them a shout out because that was typically a group that really data analytics wasn't centered around. There wasn't a huge investment in like training or platforms or tools that allowed for like operational analytics. And when we first stood up our BI program 5 years ago, they were really the first group that I focused on just because I felt like there was such a gap, not only in tools, but also in skills. And I thought that they were the, you know, quote, low hanging fruit to deliver value on BI and analytics. So that's really where we started. And we got some diamonds in the rough, to be honest, that really embraced their data sets and took some like data ownership over their particular sets and verticals within operations. And we're certainly not at a level five organization, you know, with that particular group, but there's definitely level four users that are just about self-service, where if we, let's say we bring in a new platform that has some new data points that we want to roll up into Tusker, which is our enterprise BI program. I will make the facilitation, I'll write the API calls, I'll bring the data into our common data model. But from there, they're the owner. I'm just kind of like the data steward, and I'm assisting the data along the path. And I found that that's been really helpful, because in the past, when I was kind of like doing the full life cycle of like making data connections, doing the common data model, and then building the visual layer, there was so much going back and forth because I am not in the field. I don't fully understand like deeply the meaning behind all these fields, but the folks that are touching the data every day do, and they have a better, you know, handle on it. So we were able to get to that like report outcome, the BI outcome, and have a cleaner data set at the end of the day. But yeah, props to ops, and then also props to Abigail on the 1 through 5 scale. I took some notes. I love that concept.
So that's what you said as well, though. People are hungry for data, right? Even the ones that your level 4 users, the ones that really need it, you still have to be able to provide that service. And you said, I'll just write an API call. But how many vendors said, oh, it's an easy API call, it's no work? But like, how do you actually kind of, I say, triage that demand or build your pipeline, if you will, for data to maintain the integrity and usability? Because if they're just throwing requests to you, and as you said, some of this data is very niche and specific out in the field, you know, sensors that you might not understand what they actually do. How do you keep your sanity as they're requesting this information? You obviously can't, you just bring it all in and throw it in the lake, no one's ever going to find it again. So what's that process look like for you guys? How are you dealing with these requests as they come in? How are you prioritizing? How are you making sure to maintain that fabric so it doesn't fall apart in the next release?
Yeah, so first off, it's difficult, but I have found that the key is including IT or your analytics team in the conversation at the beginning, as the new product is being purchased from the vendor, as the end user, the business users at CAR are evaluating new technologies to bring in, IT or data integrations really needs to be part of that conversation. If I'm part of it from day one, then I can really get some of the underpinnings, like some of the foundational work done as we're bringing on these new platforms, so the timeline is longer. And it's not like the team goes out, buys a new facility management platform, they stand up the whole platform, they have all this data, and then they turn it on, and the next day they're like, hey, Aaron, I need to see these, like, you know, 4 million rows records of data in the BI system tomorrow. It's kind of like a slow ramp. And the slow ramp only happens if I or IT has a good partnership with, you know, with the end users. We've been able to like kind of break down those barriers and develop relationships internally by having it like a steering committee. We follow this concept where we have a group of people that represent all the different departments. They meet with IT once a quarter, and we review kind of the pressing problems, the new projects, and just like get everybody on the same page. And we do the same with our executives, with our IT steering committee as well. And we found like that has really helped to get everybody on the same page. We're all aware of what new projects are coming. So for us on the implementation side, it's not a like surprise when these new systems come about. But at that note, there still is like, you know, always demand for, you know, for new data, and it's never fast enough.
Everyone's hungry for data. So do you ever hit a definitional challenge? Like maybe, for example, CAR defines something this way, every building operates this way, but then one building is like, no, we're different. We have to do things differently. We can't work it that way. We need something custom, we need something different. And how do you deal with that without breaking your model? Is that something you guys just have a vertical integration and say, nope, we're not doing it? Or do you have ways for users to have some flexibility without compromising integrity? How do you deal with that as these data sets keep growing and people want more specific and specific information?
Yeah, we're just having this conversation earlier this week on the term occupancy. And that's a commonly misunderstood term or misused term or used in multiple different ways amongst our industry. You probably use it a different way than I do.
Definitely, but at least 100%.
Exactly.
Occupied.
Occupied, right. Or am I talking about like foot traffic in the building, access control, counting cameras, occupancies, things like that? So for the BI program, Tusker, we have a data dictionary and definitions on how we standardize and use terminology, and then are just really careful on the like the terminology that shows up on the front end. But one of the, so it, this goes back to kind of like the strategy of how the data is set up, so there's not confusion between properties and systems. We follow this methodology of decoupling data from source systems. So everything comes into a common data model. And also the source systems that we have out in the field, we're really trying to standardize and move towards like a platform or portfolio implementation, whether that's for like facility management and work orders, BMS, access control, IoT sensors. CAR as a company, I mean, we're small, growing, you know, we're still lean, and we're trying to, and the only way really we're gonna get there is through scaling our efforts. So it really, this is like a perfect use case of why you look at, you know, rolling out platform products, so you don't have on the back end conflicting definitions of data.
Well, of the data, the new data sets you've had or the new devices you've installed, like what is the data set you're most excited about to bring to the model that you don't have yet? Or maybe you've started and haven't quite mastered. What's the newest thing that's got you excited about where your data model's going?
Yeah, so there's like a few new data sets that I'm working on that others might, it's not like the sexiest or most exciting that you might discuss, but they're new and kind of exciting because it's new for me. We're bringing in two new data sets. One is we're taking a big focus on preventative maintenance inspections in terms of compliance. Our operators and our executives really want to see those, are those required inspections for, we call them BOPs, are they being done on a routine fashion? And as they're being done, are we compliant with local laws? So that's been kind of cool because it's a sub-slice to inspections that we've looked at in the past, but we're able to like start looking at things in terms of really like government compliance and able to like score our properties on how well they're doing. The other is actually completely different sets out of facility management. It's the contracts, actually, the vendor contracts, the customer COIs. We historically have, you know, kept contracts separate, but now we're using a tool where we scrape and aggregate, and we're bringing those contract data points back into the BI tool. So property managers, assistant property managers can basically see a horizon of what's coming up for expiration, what types of like COIs do I need to be concerned about, and how does that impact like other data sets and what else is going on in my building. So those are a couple.
So when you bring this data in, right, it's obviously highly complex. Level four requires a bit of predictive, right? So maybe we didn't do some maintenance somewhere and you're finding insights that wouldn't be found by people on their own. Are your end users embracing predictive technologies, whether they be, you know, AI or just simple statistical technologies, or are they hesitant? Is there a trust issue you're encountering as you get more advanced in these processes?
So prediction, there's a difference between just like, you know, showing future expiration dates of like, this is what's coming, and then also using the data model to predict whether we think something's going to happen or predicting human behavior. The latter is really hard. We're testing it in small focused areas. One of the areas that we're trying to predict is on customer sentiment and like how much do they love our company. So we have some, we could call them algorithms. It's basically logic that looks at the repeat number of work orders. We're doing some analysis on the keywords used within work order, like descriptions or closing comments by customers, to see if there's like they're using really like, you know, strong like opinionated words on whether they're happy or unhappy. And we're trying to roll that up into a customer service, like simply a score.
But people are trusting that they're like the work order says it, they get a score, they're going for it, or are they on the fence? You just quick
yeah
answer,
I mean
it, think.
It's something that is, you know, you have to take with a grain of salt. We're getting there. So
that's awesome.
It's art, not science. It's art, not science at this point.
We did have an audience comment, a shout out more than a question. They want to give EJ from Von Chumber wanted to give you a shout out for your focus on cybersecurity. Once you get this data, you do protect it, and he thinks Carr has a leadership role in securing all these IoT devices. So kudos from the audience, if you will. And with that, Aaron, thank you. And before our next speaker, I believe we have a quick video in. Thanks, Aaron. All right, next up we have Mike Walsh. Mike, please join us. All right.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Hello. Yeah, so Mike Walsh is the development director at Leasman, an HQO company. Leasman's mission is to help organizations create great places to work at Leasman. Mike's role is focused on harnessing the power of the Leasman data set, the largest independent source of workplace experience data, to better support clients and help them achieve their workplace goals. All right, with that out of the way, tell us what we can do with all this data. We've gotten all this data. We've gone out. We've put in the sensors. We've built the warehouse. It's all there. What do we do next? Give us an example. Walk us through what you guys are finding out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I'm going to be talking you through, Andrew. So I've got a couple of slides to answer that exact question. And this is hot off the press. So this is our latest data debrief called Power of Place. And really, we looked at what part does place play? And place can mean many things. But in this case, we're looking at offices, built environments, and the home as places of work. And we're looking at the part that they play in employee experience. So I'm going to flick through. Just a little bit of context initially. Leasman own, manage, monitor, and use the world's largest database of employee workplace experience. And you're absolutely right. We do that with one goal in mind, and that's to help organizations, large and small, create great places to work using our data. And we're talking about data at scale. So we've got 1.3 million responses to office-based assessments, over 500,000 based home assessments. And that's really interesting when we think about this in this hybrid world, in this game of tug of war between office and home, because we have the ability to compare and we have the ability to benchmark to show where the office is performing well, where the home is performing well, and what the implications are for organizations across the globe. And it's always important to look at what leadership are saying when we talk about hybrid work, when we talk about the office, we talk about the home. And these days, it's never far from the front pages, and it's never far from scrutiny. And I think it's also never far from criticism as well. It's very rare that a CEO, a leader in the workplace world, implements a policy that doesn't come under criticism or scrutiny of some kind. And typically, they've got a challenge at heart. This is an example from Deutsche Bank, where they're looking to kind of load balance across the office, banning Mondays and Fridays working from home. But this was met with intense criticism. And when we think about things like talent wars, trying to attract people to businesses, things like this can have a really detrimental impact on organizations. So we're looking at this through two lenses. How are employees experiencing the environment in which they work and how well is it supporting them? And how are CEOs, leaders juggling these challenges? And what are they saying or thinking about the challenges they're facing as well? And we can draw some interesting parallels from that. So first of all, we looked at, this is a group of around 100 or so CRE leaders, and we've surveyed them since the outset of the pandemic. In this case, we're looking at 2021 to 2024 data, asking them questions simply around where their employees currently work. And the interesting takeaway here is that this growth, if you look at that second group of charts there, this growth in a purely hybrid model where people are using their offices and their homes and nothing in between. And we see on the right-hand side of that a decrease in the use of third spaces. So really giving us this indication that hybrid is here to stay, and CRE leaders are feeling this as well. And something that's front of mind for workplace leaders, real estate leaders, is footprint and ever-changing sizes of footprint and how to manage their footprint in some way. And here we're seeing pretty consistent results from 2021 right through to Q1 2024. But there's a really interesting takeaway here, and this is around the reduction. So those groups of three charts on the left-hand side show a major, considerable, or minor reduction within the next 18 months. And looking at this data, we can see two-thirds of leaders that we polled are seeing at least a change or reduction of some form in their real estate footprint. So uncertainty remains. Hybrid's here to stay. We're seeing shrinking use of third spaces. We're seeing this clear parallel between home and office as working environments. And we're seeing leaders juggle with all sorts of challenges around footprints, load balancing, the media on their back, etc. So that begs the question, you know, how do we create great places to work, and what's the purpose behind creating great places to work? And the good news is that workplaces are getting better. We've established a methodology. We call this the Leisman Index. This is a score from 0 to 100 that measures workplace effectiveness. Pre-pandemic, we were seeing our global benchmark from those 1.3 million employees at around 64.3. Doesn't take a math genius to work out that that's gone up post-pandemic. So workplaces are getting better, but there's still a challenge. And that's the home LMI, HLMI we call it, is still outperforming the office. So people are still seeing the home as a better environment to support their work than the office space. So that really begs the question. It's a question that we've got asked a lot. Why do you need an outstanding workplace in a hybrid world? And what place does an outstanding workplace provide? So we took a cut of this data and we looked at poor experiences in red, average experiences, and then great experiences to really say, well, if the home is performing so well, you know, where do these great experiences come from? What do great experiences offer that the home doesn't and the average experience offices don't as well? And that threw up some really interesting outcomes. And these were really fascinating and stuff that we've shared over the past couple of weeks since this report was published. Catalyst workplaces, or what we call outstanding workplaces, provide advantages in four key areas: pride and image, privacy and concentration, which is really interesting because that's what we consider a subset of productivity, community and working together, maybe slightly more obvious, and then creating a great place to work, an enjoyable place for those employees to work. So I'm going to take you through some of the findings. On the left, we've got average workplaces, enabler workplaces. On the right, we've got these outstanding workplaces that we often refer to as Leisman Plus. We can see a huge uptick in the number of people that agree that their place is a place that they're proud to bring visitors to in outstanding workplaces. We can also see similarly, and this is something I get asked by every leader, you know, how can we create workplaces that improve productivity across the workforce? Well, outstanding workplaces deliver this, and they deliver this against average workplaces as well. We also looked at where these Leisman Plus environments are providing great environments for work activities in particular. So we look at 21 work activities, but here we've looked at the biggest gap between average and great. And when we think about working at home, and people coming back to the office and this tug of war between the two environments, it's really interesting here that the top five biggest gaps between average and outstanding are actually those activities that you'd also consider being well supported at home because they benefit from acoustic privacy. So we often get asked, if you want to bring people back, does creating an outstanding work environment lend itself to that because you pull people away from the home? It might do. We don't know for sure, but what we can say is that outstanding workplaces deliver where the home delivers as well. So it provides that attraction and it gets people back for types of activities that are better supported there: private conversations, telephone conversations, etc. We also see some really interesting increases in support for relaxing, taking a break in outstanding places of work. And we can also see great improvements in satisfaction with features like plants and greenery, general decor, art and photography. A lot of these pretty quick wins in terms of improving the office environment as well. So the final thing I'll talk you through briefly, I know we're running out of time and this is rapid fire. The slides will be available afterwards for you. But when we're looking at getting from average to outstanding, how do we go about that? And it's interesting that variety is often a key driver of this in getting to catalyst environments. So we see along the bottom here how satisfied people are with variety of different workspaces in their environment. On the y-axis, we're seeing pride, and we can see that variety increases pride within the workplace. We can also see that variety improves productivity, as you've got more variety of different workstations to deliver the different types of work that your employees are doing. And we can also see that within the enjoyable work environment as well. Variety, lots of different places to work, interact, build communities, engage with different people, has a real driver in terms of improving the experience in the office. So I know Andrew's joined us again, so I'll promise I'll go through this pretty quickly, Andrew.
You got 30 seconds, and I do have a quick question.
No problem, I'll be quick. I just wanted to leave a couple of conclusions for the group as well. But we try and shift the conversation when we're talking to leaders. I mentioned earlier attendance rate not being the metric we focus on. We focus on employee experience, and we believe that our clients should and do as well. Looking to create great experiences in the office should be the primary focus. And outstanding workplaces give you great advantages in key corporate outcomes. Some of those I've already taken you through. And then there are seven features that we've identified as crucial in achieving those advantages. Some of those, of course, not quicker wins, larger scale design refits may be needed to adjust these, but some of these are quicker wins and often a surprise. You know, it's amazing the amount of emphasis people put on tea and coffee, or maybe it isn't, it is to me. And then the final two, you know, we often are asked, you know, can that outstanding workplace get people back to the office? You know, it's not something that we can guarantee, but what we can guarantee is when they have a great experience in the office, it will have a long lasting effect on them, even when they're at home. And then when we think about, you know, ensuring that we get the renewal of that tenancy, or we win that talent war against that other hyper focused tech organization that's in our region, we often say that the cost of creating an outstanding workplace is high, but think about the cost of not creating one. And Andrew, I hope I've given you plenty of time to throw a question.
A tiny quick question. I think Aaron's going to be frustrated because now he's going to have to go back and figure out how to install acoustic monitoring technology and how to analyze that data if the acoustics are just right for productivity. Because I had that as well. It's like being at work's great. I get to meet all my colleagues and collaborate, but it's a terrible place to host a webinar because I'm constantly being bombarded with questions, people walking into my office. So it's an interesting dichotomy there that people want the same things regardless of what they are, but maybe the how and why change a bit, and obviously being somewhere else gives you that variety. Yeah. And I'm really curious to dig into these numbers and see how you measure some of these things in your surveys, because that can probably tie into someone who's operating these properties as well to make sure they're delivering on these things in perpetuity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, no client is the same. So one of our first engagements with the client is to understand how they want the data broke down. You know, is it building by building? Is it floor by floor? Is it a new pilot space that they're looking to measure the success of there? But fundamentally, we echo the voice of the employees. We capture the employee sentiment around the workplace. We focus on three key areas: corporate outcomes, we call them workplace impact, the activities that people are doing and how well supported they are. And then we look at the features. So we look at service and technology, and then we look out, you know, the design and the layout of the environment as well. So we can break that down in a really granular way and look at them kind of line by line, or we can look at them holistically over, you know, best performing building to least performing building. So it really depends on the client needs. You know, some of our clients recently, for example, have really looked at it on a department level. So, you know, are the legal team on floor 5 having the same experience in the environment that HR are having in floor 3? And you can draw really interesting internal parallels there.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you. And every real estate is a little bit different. That's something that's constant in this business. Thank you, Mike. Apologies for the interruption. We got to keep things moving. Next to another video, Ian, you want to go ahead and bring in our next sponsor video?
LinkSpring's Edge to Enterprise for Enterprise and Multi-Sites is a turnkey smart building solution that connects, accesses, and translates operational and facility data from devices and equipment into actionable information. Information that can save energy, increase efficiency, and reduce operating costs while maintaining a higher level of comfort for occupants. The Edge to Enterprise solution consists of hardware and software combined with engineering, deployment, and professional services. It's everything you need to deploy and experience the value of a smart facility enterprise, including connectivity, integration, interoperability, automation, command and control, data access and normalization, analytics, and cloud services.
All right. Next up, we have Mark Pitok. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Andrew. Good morning. Good afternoon. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you. I'm doing great here in New York, where it is just turned to afternoon. Mark Pitok is a pioneer in leading the intelligent smart buildings and M2M movements, pushing the industry forward, and has contributed to transforming and changing the intelligent buildings and M2M, now IoT, industries. As Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for LinkSpring, Mark leads corporate and product marketing, strategy, brand management, public relations, and communications that support the company's strategic growth initiatives. So M2M is now IoT, and what is coming next? How do we bring this all together, Mark?
That's a good question. I think if we had that answer, instead of winning, you know, the Powerball or something, I think we would all be enriched. But I'm kind of, you know, again, very impressed what Abigail and Aaron had shared with us. I'm going to bring this down to the true OT level is where I want to take this whole discussion, data fabric discussion around. So across the built environment, we are continuing to see advances with OT data. And again, I'm talking about OT data. Advances include the types of OT data that is now available to us, how this data can be used, and most importantly, the outcomes that it delivers. So there's no doubt, I think everybody today agrees that OT data in the built environment holds immense value in terms of optimizing operations, battling against rising energy costs, contributing to a sustainable environment, and most importantly, increasing the value, the asset of that particular building. So one of these advancements within the OT data space is the creation of everybody's got their own names, a common enterprise OT data management platform, a mouthful indeed. So let's kind of drill down into this. So what does a platform, an enterprise OT data platform, kind of look like? So essentially, it's a platform, a framework that creates cohesive edge to cloud experience that enables data integration and data interoperability. That last word, interoperability, is what I see as probably the most important element in any kind of strategic data plan or implementation that anybody needs to do today. It allows the data to be democratized, made available in the right format, delivered to the right person or persons at the right place, at the right time, and what we've kind of touched on a little bit earlier, it within a secured environment. So, you know, how do you do that? How does this enterprise OT data platform do this? Well, it securely connects to the operational systems and the equipment within the building, all those disparate systems, all those disparate devices. And it collects, it normalizes, it aggregates and standardizes, models, and visualize all of this data from all these different sources into one independent data layer is a way to kind of look at that. And that data layer is accessed through one common user interface. So further, look at it as it's creating a common data vocabulary, a common data classification, and a common data relationship between all these different systems and devices that operate our buildings today. In addition, once that data is normalized, it's there, additional applications such as what we've talked about, analytics, work order management, energy management, and system optimization applications, and sustainability, ESG applications can be applied. So also to keep in mind that it's got to be vendor agnostic, and to ensure that you, a building owner or operator, in fact owns that data. Now, moving on a little bit, let's kind of look at a visual that I try to put together for us here. So look at the data on the OT data on the left. Look at the sources: HVAC, lighting, legacy systems, sensors, web services, you name it. There's lots over there, different applications. Some kind of mechanism, and in this case, I'm using a controller, a device, a centralized data enabler to bring all of that data together, and then hooking it up to that independent data layer where that raw data is brought together, the service data, the metadata, real-time data, all of that is put together, as I said earlier, normalized, modeled, and then it is then tagged and curated, stored and secured. So what's the benefit of that is everybody, anybody who is using the data, the independent data layer, is using the same data. It's defined the same way. So you're not getting many, many different sources of data and people not understanding, well, what do you mean? I don't understand what that data means. And then being able to apply that same centralized data with these analytics. We've heard predictive, we've heard preventive, FDD, energy, equipment performance, delivering it to the different stakeholders, whether it be dashboards, getting alarms, notifications, issuing reports, and most importantly, looking at the outcomes. And you'll notice here that I've got two types of outcomes. There's an operational outcome, and then there's a business outcome. What is this contributing? What kind of business outcomes are you looking to do for your buildings? And moving on a little bit, so let's look at some OT data use cases. Of course, these by far are not all of them. They're just some of the main ones that I see that we've been involved with, et cetera. Fault detection, predictive maintenance, energy analysis and management, prioritizing operational issues on their relative cost and or occupant impact, identifying the different sensors that are drifting out of calibration, comparing a facility ops on a typical day, comparing it to a non-typical day based on real-time occupancy, weather-related issues, occupant and space utilization. How are we, you know, at 50% capacity today in our building, or and where is everybody? Are they in a third floor, fourth floor, whatever? Obviously, today, decarb and sustainability, indoor air quality. And most importantly, its contribution to the value, to the asset, to the building itself. And again, looking at why OT data, and I think you look at it, increases the lifespan of your building systems and equipment. Most importantly, let's say the average lifetime value of air handlers are 10 years, 15 years. Utilizing the data, you can extend that lifetime value of those pieces of equipment, maybe get another 5-6 years out of those. So you don't have to go to the well and draw money out, which we all know is in today's time can be very challenging. And in summary, look at the data produced from all this OT systems is more valuable than the cost of those devices and those systems. The data is more valuable than the cost. And I think the use of data today is not a nice have anymore, it's a must have. So with that, Andrew, let me turn it back to you.
Yeah, I have a question you raised here, and I think it's a very interesting one, because I think people generally agree, yes, they understand the value of this data, they understand how it can increase the value of their asset, whether they're looking to take out to refinance a loan, sell the asset, or just have to attract the best tenants. But it's a challenge here, if you're a technologist at a real estate company, there's all these devices and every building is different. So what should I, as you know, I'm a CIO at a real estate company, let's just say, and I'm looking at these devices everywhere with different buildings, different types. What's the responsibility of the device manufacturer and for the device to provide? And what's the responsibility of the software that's gathering that and centralizing it? How do you define that and who owns what? It's going to be very tricky with different devices and different setups to really navigate that potential conflict as you try to bring all this together. Because you can't connect the data, it's not very useful, but not everybody wants to play nice to each other in this marketplace.
Exactly. And I think that right there, what you just defined, is indeed one of the biggest challenges that many of us on the OT side face each and every day. Obviously, as we know, sensors, there are thousands of different kinds of sensors out there. And unfortunately, many don't want to play nice. But I think today there is software, integration software, that is bringing all of this together. Is it easy? No. But is it doable? 100% absolutely it is doable. And I think too is the responsibility. I think it is people like us, like a Linkspring, who is a technology company who is producing solutions and products that deliver, that connect and deliver the data. It's applications people as well. And ultimately, if I was a building owner and operator, I would insist all of my vendor suppliers who are looking after this OT data for me, that you all have to play nice. If you can't, I will find one who can.
The customer is always right, as it
correct.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it. Appreciate the oversight there.
Sure.
Up next, we have another video from MRI Software. Ian, you want to kick us off?
What would happen if we dared to intersect our physical and digital worlds? Could we defy expectations and dream of something new? Something better, smarter, more connected, more human. At MRI, this is the question we ask ourselves, and our answer is MRI Agora, the world's first hyper-connected, AI-powered, and human-centric prop tech platform. MRI Agora is the culmination of a decades-long vision to bridge the gap between all technology in the prop tech industry, connecting real estate visionaries with AI-first solutions that power every part of their business. Solutions that use smart data to break down barriers and deliver deeper insights. Solutions that build thriving communities. Solutions that make the world a better place to live, work, and play for every member of society. Today, the wait is over, and a new era of connectivity, commerce, and community begins with MRI Agora.
All right, thank you. Next we have Ian Nabok, the Director of Global Data Services for MRI Software. Ian brings over 25 years of software design and development experience to MRI. He works with global organizations, including Lego, Rail Italia, Kimco, and GrowthPoint, focused on integration, data modeling, and data standards. Ian also spearheaded the development of new real estate data and reporting platform, integrating communication across 300 solutions globally. Not 299, but 300 solutions globally. Thank you, Ian. Bring us home. How do we do? What's the story at the end of this the end of the webinar here?
Yeah, thanks very much, Andrew. It's great to be here, and hello everyone. So I think the main focus I want to talk about today is kind of our real life experience at MRI as we've gone through a data journey ourselves, defining our own data strategy and for our clients and solutions that affect our clients. So I guess to kick us off is the reason why, and I'm going to use the word why a lot as I start talking, but When I was asked to start looking at our internal and our client data ecosystems back in 2020, 2021, thinking of back to what Abby was saying earlier about data maturity, I'll be quite open in saying that it was pretty clear we were probably somewhere between a level one and a level two, maybe closer to a level one. Internally, we had a large number of solutions, well in excess of 100 software solutions out in our client base at that time. We had data silos and data swamps, so too much disparate data in multiple locations, no common standards, different regions handling the same type of data in different ways. And with a number of acquisitions every year, the problem was growing exponentially. So to start us on our journey to maturity, we identified a few steps that we needed to take. And as part of that, immediately highlighted what we saw as the most important considerations. The first, and this is what I see as the most important, is always identify why you're doing something. And there's a phrase that's said a lot, but it's key here. And just because you can doesn't mean that you should. You also need to accept the fact, and a couple of people have already said this, there isn't any kind of one-size-fits-all solution to your individual challenges. There's a huge amount of information out there talking about data strategies, data governance and security, and we digested as much of that as we possibly could as the foundation as we built our own strategy. Now, on top of this, it's very, very important that you don't see a data strategy as a project. It never has an end date. You'll always be refining your processes to meet internal or regulatory demands, and defining that strategy really is only the first step in your journey. It needs to be implemented and then constantly reviewed and improved upon. Finally, this might be the bottom of the list, but communication is key. Establishing committees and working groups is very important, but those groups need to communicate with the wider organization as much as possible. For the implementation of a strategy to be successful, you've got to get buy-in from all levels and all areas of your organization. And the best way to achieve that really is for them to feel involved in the process rather than dictated to once you've already decided what you're doing. Now, moving on to really what we actually did, and I don't have time to talk about every one of these points in detail on the diagram on the right-hand side, but you can see the main areas of focus that we included in our strategy. Now, the items of most importance are the fact that everything here is equal. No one point is more important than the other, and without each of them, the others are all at risk of failure. Also, never base your strategy on specific technology. Always focus on the people, the processes, and the use of technology. Now, for those of you out there in global organizations, regional variances are always going to exist. Think about the data privacy laws across different states in the US compared to the GDPR regulations across Europe. Now, your strategy needs to include the processes to govern all of these nuances. Now, obviously, this is our model. You can define your own, and that links back to my comment earlier about a one-size-fits-all solution. So to cover quickly how we started to apply that strategy, a few points that we completed very early on. There are a few challenges that you may come across during this type of journey, and those of you that have already been through this will be familiar with a lot of these. One is obviously cost. You'll be forming new groups, new teams, you'll be adding additional work for certain people and potentially adding additional processes to your teams or implementing new software. And everyone's organization needs to accept this, and they need to be aware of its importance. Secondly, everyone has to buy into this strategy. The approach that we found most effective was to start small, identifying some very specific use cases, identifying the most enthusiastic teams, and constantly refining those processes as we roll this out further, using successes as use cases and examples going forward. And then finally, back to the engagement point. We held weekly and monthly updates for the entire business. We had an open feedback channel, and we actively looked for suggestions from the teams actually implementing the strategy on how we could improve. Okay, so moving on to one of the outcomes that I think has had the biggest impact on both ourselves and our clients. That's a solution that we named MRI Agora Insights. Essentially, it's a data consolidation and reporting platform based on very similar architecture to that Mark's just described, and Aaron and Abby were talking about earlier. And first, we built this to be used internally. We used it for our own internal reporting, financial and development level reporting, and then subsequently made it available to our clients.
Now, it starts with a data consolidation layer, and that's where we move all of our data into a data lake. A couple of reasons for doing this. One's to separate all the detailed and heavyweight analysis from the operational databases, remove any risk of performance impact, and also to allow us to track data changes over time. I think everyone's aware some products and some solutions are better than others at tracking changes to data. By doing this first move, we can track all that and then enable further on some sort of trend analysis and predictive analysis. Secondly, we have the transformation layer, and that's really where the clever stuff happens. So we define some sets of common data models for all areas, and we chose the OSCAR industry data model as the core solution for real estate related data, but then we built our own models for anything that didn't really fit that model. And we have flexible pipelines that take all of the data from our data lake and transform it into these models. And that again goes back to some points that the other presenters have made around creating that one single common data model that's very, very easy to understand, easy to use, and doesn't rely on any knowledge of the kind of underlying product data sets and data sources. And finally, we have the visualization options. Now that covers both your traditional dashboards, so we use Power BI, and also something that we called Insights Anywhere. And that allows us to take any of the data from our data warehouse and surface it inside any web-based application using a simple browser plugin. And it's a tooltip style interface. So it's really putting the power of the data that we've captured and processed into the hands of the users. And to reiterate a point that was made earlier, giving that data to the right people in the right place at the right time. So just to finish off and summarize, a few of our key takeaways. The strategy really isn't about just how you use the data, it's the processes you have in place, both from a personnel and a technology perspective. You can take inspiration from others, and I'd certainly encourage that and create a strategy that fits your organization and the culture within your organization. Communicate a lot and keep communicating. Never be afraid to take feedback and change direction if you need to. Identify the key benefits and the biggest return on investment early on, and certainly don't aim to solve everything on day one. And I'll reiterate the last point again, most importantly, always ask why.
Excellent. Thank you, Ian. One thing you brought up, which is funny, as a software company, it's a very common issue in real estate as well, is that through acquisition, you had silos, you had technical debt. Obviously, in real estate, you do a portfolio deal in a different region or a different asset class, and all of a sudden, you have all these problems with your data model, technology, et cetera. How did you know you had a problem, first of all? And then secondly, was there anything you'd recommend if you know you have technical debt incoming you can do to prepare to bring it in and make it work with what you've already got operating?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if you look back a number of years, when we realized that or the scale of the problem that we had was as we grew globally and started to acquire more and more organizations, the demand of reporting and analysis across the business grew exponentially. So the sort of senior management, the senior leadership asking for more and more reports, more and more information, and just observing the processes that people had to go through to collate that information. Things like CRM systems are a very good example. We at one point, I think, had in excess of 20 different CRM solutions capturing leads and sales and contracts, and trying to consolidate all of that data was a manual exercise for a very long time. I'm sure everybody's familiar with extracting information into Excel sheets and trying to consolidate and combine, deduplicate all of the usual sorts of challenges. I think that was the point where we really identified there was a problem.
So if you're relying on Excel, you might have a problem in your data strategy is what you're saying. Excellent. Awesome. With that, let's bring everybody back. We have about 20 minutes left. We can do a quick roundtable discussion here with all of our panelists. I know Mike Walsh did have to depart. He is over in England, so he's about 6 hours ahead of us. So we thank him for joining when he could. I'm looking for Aaron as well. All right. Welcome back, everyone. So one question that came in from the audience was specifically to Mike, who had to depart, so I can't ask it to him, but I'll ask to the panel. It was about visualization. And this was like asking about specific tools. Ian, you mentioned Power BI, but not necessarily the tools themselves. I want to elaborate on the question a bit myself and editorialize. How important is the visualization to realize the value from the strategy? Is the visualization tool the most important, the least important? Do you start with the dashboard you want and work backwards, or do you have to have the data first before you can build? Talking through the role visualization plays in realizing value from in your organizations from the data? Maybe Ian, you can start, you just mentioned it in your second to last slide, but I'd like to see a poll kind of from everybody and the importance of visualization. Are people, is it overrated, underrated? What do you think about it in terms of being the final step in the data journey?
That's interesting. I'll maybe give you two different answers to that. I think early on in the journey, and certainly when we were looking at requirements, visualization was very, very important, probably the most important thing that we were looking at. And we were doing exactly as you described, Andrew, looking at the visualization requirements and then working backwards to try and define the data models. And I think from our perspective, we realized that was the wrong way around to suit our needs. It gave you a solution to your problem as of today, but didn't future-proof what you were looking to achieve going forward. So we sort of reversed that decision and then started looking more at the data, how we can model the data effectively to protect ourselves from requirements going forward.
Yeah, I'll throw it to you next, Ab, because visualization is a key from getting to level one to level two, but like, can it swing the other way and hold you back if you're just, you know, visualization focused?
So to a certain extent, it depends on your audience. So I think some of my new colleagues at Kimco have heard me talk about, like, do you develop a user journey? Do you go start doing user stories? And what are users going to do with your end data? Because if you don't start with the business problem first, I feel like you end up getting in trouble later when you have all of your data stuff, because you can spend a lot of money building a data stack that doesn't do what people want. So that's kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, because visualization is important, like, especially if your key users are your executive team. Your executive team is going to want it to look great, right? But then if your key users are individual contributors, do you really need a visualization? And you might get feedback like, I don't want that. I like to see it in the table. I need to get into the weeds to understand what things are. So the more you understand your users, like, the better question you're going to get, answer you're going to get to a question like that.
Yeah. And Mark, you're always about has to deliver value, but is the value always a visualization, or is it not necessarily what you mean when you're talking about value for the asset?
Well, yeah. And again, the value is the data, and that it's, you know, one common, everybody's working from the same pool. Now, on visualization, echo a little bit what Abigail said, is this: you have different stakeholders, different users who are using that same data. So take a financial person, for example. They may perceive, they want to look at things visually a certain way versus a facility manager versus somebody else. So I think visualization is important, but there's not one centralized visualization. It's customized to the person and what they need that information for to ensure the outcomes. And, you know, if we look at ourselves as humans, we see things visually first, and we look at tabs and tables and all that stuff second, third, or fourth, you know, down the road. So, and I think one last thing to comment is, especially on the OT side, not everybody understands the data that's coming from the OT side. They may understand data from a business perspective or the front end of the office leases and things like that, but OT data is a whole different world to understand and comprehend it.
Yeah, and then Aaron, Ekar, when you guys are building a new analytic to drive operations in your buildings, are you starting with kind of the visual first that people are going to work from day in, day out, or are you starting from the data side and the visualization is coming after? Like, what's your strategy there?
Yeah, so we really start the visualization piece at the beginning to QA the data. It's actually really helpful if you can bring raw data into a BI tool just to even start, like, understanding the quality and start to, like, before you even start modeling. So that's actually been, we've gotten two sort of use cases out of the tool, not just from the end user, like, consumer side of it, but on the development side. We get to see, is the data coming through what we're expecting? Do we understand it? And start to, like, QA just things that we need to learn about it, like how much, how frequent, what are the fields that we're going to need to learn and map and things like that. So I echo really what the rest of the group said, but in addition, really at the forefront of any project, I like to bring it into the visualization tool initially, just a QA.
I really like that point you make, because it is kind of innate and intuitive when you look at a visualization. Like, you can tell it's wrong. You might not need time to figure out why it's wrong, but you can tell it's wrong. We actually quick anecdote. We had this problem, a chart just wasn't rendering, it was looking bizarre, the results made no sense. And then we found out that in the data set, there was a couple values way out the tail end that was an order of magnitude larger than it should have been because of miscalculations upstream. And like, oh, now it all makes sense. But we knew right away that the chart was wrong before we could figure out why it was wrong. So it can be very helpful to QA.
Or you're looking at a set of data for your properties and you're saying, wait, we don't have a property named null.
The classic null.
I like it when you do the maps and it's like, wait, we don't have a property in Africa. What happened there?
Zero. Awesome. Audience question for Abigail and Aaron, but anyone can feel free to chime in as well. Are there any tried and true strategies for addressing data literacy and ownership in an organization? It always comes back. No one wants to take responsibility and no one wants to read a long email. How do you, any strategies you guys or tips you have to get buy-in from people to do this work?
I can take it first if Aaron, you don't mind. So when I look at it, there is usually someone within the organization who's doing that job today. They just aren't recognized as the person that's doing that job, right? There's someone that's taken it upon themselves. So part of what you can do as the data person is to start ferreting out who those people are in your organization, who's already doing the job today, and can we raise the visibility of what those people are doing? And then the other thing that I find a lot is IT is in usually a pretty unique place within the organization where you get to talk about a bunch of, like, you talk to a bunch of different groups, you hear about a lot of different people's problems. And so you get a unique view where you're saying, well, like the leasing org has this problem and the accounting org has this problem, but they're actually the same problem and they just don't know because they're not talking to each other. So some of that I take as how do you as the horizontal layer start building those relationships between people, because the more people can start talking about things, the more they get involved, the more you can show them things like what we were just talking about with visualizations where we're like, oh yeah, this is wrong, and highlight like here's how this affects your day-to-day, the more people get buy-in, because what people really don't want is for their day-to-day life to be harder. So if you can show them how it makes everything easier, they'll be more likely to jump on board with what you're asking them to do.
One takeaway on my side, in terms of getting adoption for maybe a nascent user, with each data set that comes in, if you have a new data set that people need to learn, start introducing the data through a view and relabel the data in common terms that the team knows. So the table, it doesn't have to be like the full table, make a view, like kind of simplify it and start from there.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about, Ian, this one may be for you as well, kind of the multinational angle, when you do have silos and you do have teams that like are not communicating from a data perspective, obviously it's not as simple as just saying, hey guys, you got to work together more. Are there technologies or actual, software type approaches as well beyond just speaking to folks and getting them in a room and communications? Are there actual tools you can use to drive that collaboration cross silo, cross region, cross department?
Yeah.
Or is it all just elbow grease and long conversations?
Probably a combination of all of the above. There are tools designed around collaboration. We use a few things internally. We use Jira for all of our development environments and Confluence for a lot of sort of information sharing and collaboration. And obviously Teams, like everybody else does, for communication, that can be a blessing in disguise sometimes. And I think we've implemented some processes directly within Jira for handling our development projects. So if certain types of activities are completed, it sort of flags up follow-up actions. If let's say one product is integrated with another product, if you make changes to one of the APIs, it automatically triggers some QA activities on those APIs and integration activities. So it doesn't explicitly push people to communicate more, but it sort of triggers that level of communication. And it's a culture thing a lot more than anything else. Data silos are one thing, but teams working in silos probably create more problems than the data itself.
Yeah, one thing we struggle with is that the final pane of glass where users consume their data is not necessarily collaborative, right? It may be exactly what they need. They may be able to apply their slicers and filters and get to their answer and then do the make the decision, but it's not really a collaborative way of working when you're kind of consuming, you know, lots of data. And oftentimes what happens is the output of all this complex modeling and collaboration and building these beautiful dashboards is someone just sends an email. And now we're back to where we started, where the key decision or the key information we need is just sitting in somebody's inbox, and they're not able to actually drive the collaboration through the end product. And I'm hoping the marketplace can evolve a bit to realize that people need data to make almost every decision, sometimes more, sometimes less. But our data tools are great for getting data, but they're not necessarily great for doing anything with it and actually memorializing the decision or even providing feedback. I think something we can talk about too, maybe Marcus comes to you as well. Like, once you've built this pane of glass and brought this all together, how do you capture user feedback to make it better? Because there's always something people out there know that you don't, and you have to bring that back into your data model.
And, you know, to that point, I think, as Ian said, you're never done at the end of the day. Is okay, you build it, you design it, you strategically think, all right, we've got what we want. We operate it, and 6 months, a year, whatever, we've got to modify it. And I think that's important, that nothing is forever, that whatever tools you use, whatever, you've got to figure out that, can I change? Can I add? Can I take away? And I think that's important, that it's just not taking it out of a box, plugging it in, and we're set to go. One thing, do you mind if I ask a question?
No, please. Okay.
All right. So, we cannot go a day without hearing these two letters, AI. No doubt the AI gold rush is in full swing. No question. And within AI, one of the key components, whatever AI you're talking about, is going to be the data, all right, without a doubt. So what, especially my panel colleagues, and you too, Andrew, of course, you know, what is y'all's view on data and its role and its relationship to AI?
I don't think there's a single senior technologist at an organization these days who hasn't had either a board member or a C-level person come in and just read a fancy glossy magazine saying, are we AI ready? How are we going to be AI ready? Trying to roll my eyes, right? So I think that it's really back to what makes data fabric work. And it's really not the data itself. It's the metadata, the data about the data. If your metadata is clean and tidy and governed and actually works across multiple data sets, you can build cohesive data products that AI can use, because AI is going to be another customer of you. Mm-hmm. Human intelligence is reading your data every day, using it, making decisions. Artificial intelligence will have similar needs. Now, obviously, they're not as smart as people and not as flexible, but they have similar needs. Think of them as a consumer of your data. How do you build a product they can actually use? And for us, the strategy now is, let's get that metadata as broad as we can, as clean as we can, so that when these things start actually moving, they're not just spitting out nonsense. Am I skeptical? Obviously, it comes through in my tone of voice, I think. But our strategy is to think of them as any other consumers, that they need clean data, they need reliable data. How do you do that? It's governance, it's metadata management. Those not very sexy things are becoming very important now that this bright new shiny object's in front of everybody. What are other people's thoughts?
Yeah, I think I am. Sorry, you go ahead first.
No, we're all just going to jump in. Everybody's so excited to talk about AI. Well, it also comes down to, like, what from the business, like, what's your tolerance for risk, right? Because I have very rarely in my career seen an AI tool that is 100% correct all the time. And sometimes you go talk to people and they're like, well, it just has to be right. And you're like, well, you're not going to get that. I mean, even when you do it on an intuition basis, you're not 100% right all the time. So what is your tolerance for risk? So there are things that are coming out today, like with generative AI, where they're saying it's actually really bad at reading financial results. And if you want to ask it questions about your financial results, expect to get an answer that's wrong. And do you want to look embarrassed when you're talking on a platform where other people can hear you that you're quoting an incorrect statistic? You need to keep that in mind. So as technologists, I think we need to come in and start figuring out where are those guardrails so that we can start telling people, like, here are things you need to look out for and here are things that are careful. Because I think what they find is the more that you automate things, the more people stop thinking critically about what they're doing. And once you stop thinking critically, you're going to come out and say things that maybe it becomes embarrassing to your organization. Maybe it leads you to make a wrong and costly decision later. And so we need to help everybody understand, like, those are risks that you're taking on.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I had a fascinating conversation just this morning on the subject of AI. And it was, AI itself was likened to a toddler in that it will believe everything that you tell it and it will repeat everything that you tell it. And that kind of links to the data quality conversation. If you feed it wrong data, it will give you wrong answers. But then one of the people I was speaking to actually likens the people who use AI to toddlers as well, in that they will believe everything that the AI tells them. I think that's a kind of polarizing effect that we're seeing at the moment. People either 100% trust what they're told or they completely distrust what they're told.
Is it like, yeah, my toddler and also leaving mess? Sorry. Yeah,
the AI, I mean, certainly, yes, data is the underpinning. It's the knowledge base. But the question of, are you AI ready? You're really just, are you AI, like, getting started? The data that gets fed through AI into the, you know, in the future that we're going to use will constantly need refinement and it will need continued training. I'm not sure if you guys saw I'm not sure how authentic it was, but the story about Amazon Go earlier this week, mm-hmm, that, you know, the quick service shop that you just walk in, take stuff and leave, that come to find out that they said they had 1,000 humans offshored that were basically making the system go, that were watching the videos, that were teaching the models, and were, like, monitoring the systems. And, like, one of the points of failure was they didn't have enough, like, people to keep the system running, and there was too much human intervention that was needed. So anyways, not to say that, like, video analysis and video AI is not ready, but that's just an example of something that we thought was ready. It rolled out. It turns out it wasn't. They couldn't scale it. It was too expensive, too much human involvement. But that doesn't mean that we should stop pressing forward. It just means, like, proceed cautiously.
Yeah. And then, define predictive in level four.
I was going to say, don't believe everything you see that vendors say, because they may have stuff behind the scenes that they're just not letting you know about.
Yeah. And that's my question to you, is, like, is AI going to be level six, or is it really just going to be a component at each level as tools sort of mature to do what you
do? I mean, for me, like, that's where my, like, level five is. Like, AI is just making all of your decisions for you, and you don't have to worry about it, right? Like,
you don't have to go to work anymore.
Yeah.
Awesome. That's actually the end of time, guys. Thank you so much. We have just a couple minutes left. Lisa, if you want to come on and wrap us up, I know we got to thank our sponsors one more time while we outro here.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank all of our panels. Andrew, thank you. Great job moderating. Lots of really good information, lots of information to process, all very good perspectives. Also, thanks to Mike for coming in. I know it was a bit late for him. So thank you to the live audience for being with us and tuning in. Whether you joined us live or you're watching this as a recording, thank you again. And be sure to register for our next webinar on April 18th. That's coming up, and it's on the topic of smart building technology, revolutionizing efficiency, cost-effective futures. Also, be sure to register early for the RealCom IBCon conference happening June 20th and 21st in Tampa, Florida. Our charity golf event benefiting Stacks and Jewels is June 18th, FreeCon June 19th in the Tampa Bay Convention Center. That is it for us today. Thank you again for tuning in. We wish you a very safe and happy Thursday.
Thank you, Lisa. Looking forward to playing golf in June.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks, everybody. Everyone.